we start a new theme. That may be one way to kind of organize this mass of confusion. It does proceed in themes, I believe. Because the theme that starts now is, in a way, a return to what we've been doing, where we've got the ego on the earth and the source of inspiration as symbolized by being in heaven. So you could say it's a precursor of ego and self. Ego on the earth, the self in heaven. Meaning that the ego's business is dealing with reality. And yet there is a source of inspiration, there's a source of wisdom, there's the plan of our lives, there's the plan of our destiny, which exists on another plane. And that true living is a shuttling back and forth between those two dimensions. So, who appears on 335 but the soul? And the soul is at a distance. Soul says, 5 lines down, I am above you. I am a world apart. I've become sun-like. I receive the seeds of fire. Well, the reason the soul has received the seeds of fire, that's what we just did for the last how many ever pages. And so he's now seeing that there is a higher, and I don't like that word, but a more comprehensive, there's a voice that represents his ideals, the destiny of his life, his hopes and dreams, what he can accomplish, and that stands as a source of information and inspiration to the ego that has to be about paying taxes, paying mortgage, keeping the yard mowed, dealing with neighbors, and so on. And I think the great, there's two dangers. One, that you live in the world of possibility and you never actualize any of it. That would be living in the soul's world. And the other is that you live only in time and space and you don't listen to your values, you don't listen to your goals, you don't listen to what you're capable of, you don't take your talent seriously, because from the point of view of reality, that all seems so either banal or impossible or flighty.
What confused me with some of the language here is that the soul is carrying the seeds of fire.
Yes.
And Jung keeps talking about living into the dark dampness of the earth.
Yes.
And to me, those seeds need to go into that dark dampness
yes.
in order to grow.
Yes.
But here he's asking that they be kept apart. Am I misunderstanding?
No,
that?
let's look at that. Maybe we should just go through that almost sentence by sentence, at least for a while, because it's instructive. So I'm above you, okay? Then he says, I am down on the murky earth in the dark smoke that the fire left us. And my gaze does not reach you, but your voice sounds closer. The soul says, I feel that the heaviness of the earth penetrates me, damp cold enshrouds me, gloomy memories of former pain overcome me. Now that's a warning that the I'm going to call the soul the world of possibility, and I'm going to call the ego the world of necessity, just to give it shorthand. That possibility is being lost because the demands of what is necessary seem to overshroud it. That's what I think is going on.
So is this like when we talked about the self needed to be lamed and the human being needed to be blinded?
I don't think so.
Okay.
It's just that, you know, you have it in you to produce a work of art, whatever that might be. Well, the voice in time and space is, why bother? It's going to take a lot of time. You're not going to make any money. No one's going to be interested. So you give it up. At that point, the soul has been consumed by the murky earth. That we've got to keep possibility is a difficult word, because maybe say genuine, they call it genuine potential versus necessity. That, because possibility can be like, well, I can do anything, but no. That what your hopes and dreams and values and gifts and talents and capacities are, often in the face of cold reality, look silly or hopeless or stupid or unimportant. You know, why write a book? There are already 2 million books in the Indianapolis Marion County Public Library. What does one more book add? Nothing. So why don't I just go out and have a beer? Well, unfortunately, it's your book. And that is as important as those other million books in that library. And that book wants to be written. That book doesn't care how many other books there are.
It's like that quote from George, that writer George Saunders. He said he was asked, you know, the same question of his students. You know, why teach somebody how to write? Why do they want to express anything? And he said, because that expression gives the human being dignity. Doesn't matter whether
exactly.
It's ever published.
Yeah.
It's in the writing and what they learn from that
yeah.
about themselves that gives them dignity.
Yeah. See, that's a man who is working on both potential and reality. Mm-hmm. And that's what we always have to do. And the temptation is always to flip to one side or the other. So the soul says, I feel the heaviness of the earth penetrate me, damp, cold, enshrouds me. And then Jung says, do not lower yourself into the smoke and darkness of the earth. I would like that which I am still working on to remain sunlight. So keep your ideals true. Otherwise, I will lose courage. I will lose the courage to live further down on the darkness of the earth. So, I mean, I think that is so important. If you listen to how most people describe their lives, they talk about their ideals of adolescence as foolish. And they've given them up and they've gotten real. And, of course, then their body falls apart in later age. So what Jung is saying is don't give up your ideals. Live in the tension between your ideals, your potential, and the earth. And strive to make those ideals real. Don't give them up because they seem unrealistic. Suffer the crucifixion between reality and your ideals, or reality and your potential. And I think what you say is so beautiful, because that's what makes life worth living. I think surely we live in a time, and I think psychology is one of the biggest culprits in this, of deconstructing people's ideals, because they're not realistic.
Except where you're at and what you've got.
Except where you're at and what you've got, yeah.
Gets them ready to go back out into their lives.
Be good little robots. And any thought that is not in accord with reality is deconstructed. Rather than saying, good, this is what you believe. Now, how are you going to get it? So Jung is saying, don't stop informing me of my inspirations. Just let me just hear your voice. I'll never want to see you in the flesh again. I don't think he's going to get that wish granted. In other words, he's going to always be involved with desire and inspiration. say something, take it from the depths from which fear perhaps flows to me. And then she says, I cannot, since your creative source flows from there. So the soul is saying, I am a separate reality. I don't get my inspiration from the earth. I give the earth inspiration.
I plant the seed.
I plant the seed. So we still got a little bit of this, well, I wish I could get rid of this love problem. That's still in here, a little bit. And she says, your creative source flows from there. In other words, it's from your desirousness that you have the love of life, which is the source of your creative drive.
So when she says, I cannot, what she's referring to, just to be clear on what she cannot do, is she cannot be totally out of the flesh.
Let me see. Wait a second, Carl.
He says, I will never want to see you in the flesh again. Say something. Take it from the depths from which fear perhaps flows into it. And she says, I cannot take it from the depths, since your creative force flows from that. In other words, she says, though she's... I'm trying to understand that.
Yeah.
Is she saying that I cannot? I've got to be in the flesh sometimes.
No, just the opposite, I think.
Okay.
That I can never leave the realm of potential.
But he can never leave the realm of the flesh.
But he can never leave the realm of the flesh. Mm-hmm. And the realm of potential can't change because it looks unrealistic. Just because your ideals don't seem to fit into your life, that's not the problem of the ideals, that's the problem of your life. That's, I believe, what he's working with here.
So he's saying, no, I cannot be flesh again.
Yeah. Well,
it's just not clear.
Yeah, let me see. I think she will appear through the flesh, but her reality will always remain separate.
That he will experience her.
He will experience her through the flesh,
yeah.
But she is not going to change her point of view because of the state of reality. In other words, Jungian psychology has to be born. It's not going to make compromises with the world in its birth.
Well,
I don't really know. The self as a concept, I don't think was clear to him yet. There again, I would be a little careful about throwing labels on it. If you wanted to put a label on it, I think I'd be more likely to say the anima. But the anima communicates the self. So in a way, it is the self. In these ambiguous cases, I more prefer just to say, what is that voice saying? Forget the labels. What's it saying? Now, yes, I guess we could step back and say, well, it's got some aspects of the anima, positive anima. Certainly, the positive anima is a servant of the self in the best sense. In other words, that the man's, or anyone's eros, if it's genuine, will communicate the design of the self. But it gets so complicated that I would just stick with what's she saying. Whatever it is, it's pretty trustworthy, but like any voice, we also have to scrutinize it.
Didn't Jung once say that the thing we forget is that in the beginning, the entire unconscious is the shadow?
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. That might be the closest we could get to it here. Though I think some of, if we wanted to give our little concept a workout, I think some of that shadow has been worked through in that previous beating up series. Mm-hmm. And so we're moving more into the positive anima. But the positive anima and the self are very, well, they're in league, because when the anima is working, she communicates the point of view of the self. It's her point of view, but she's getting it from the self. That makes sense?
She's a messenger.
She's a messenger, yeah.
When you say in the beginning?
I don't remember the quote, and I don't remember where it is, but basically it was Jung speaking to analysts, and he was saying, what you forget when you're looking at, is this from the shadow, the anima, or the self, is that in the, as you begin to work with the unconscious, it's all glum together, so it's all shadow, and then you have to tease out the pieces and what is helpful and what is not. That's the process.
Yeah.
Was my understanding.
Yeah, say before you've mucked around in your psyche, when these shadow figures appear, they carry everything. And then you slowly pick things out.
One of my earliest dreams in analysis was that there was a man who was telling me I had to untangle his hair, and basically he had dreadlocks. So I'm like trying to untangle his hair.
That's it. But again, I think the big point is we're getting two dimensions of reality, the higher and the lower. And that's working through this whole column. That you don't forget what your potential is, how the potential can often seem at variance with what is realistically possible, what your goals, your values, your ideals are, that they often seem at variance with reality. And if they do, don't compromise one for the other. Live in that tension and continue listening to both sides. Yeah, you've got to meet the demands of reality. You've got to worry about your credit rating. You've got to worry about neighbors and God knows what else, sewers. I'm getting mine installed. But, you know, don't forget there's this other world. You have to deal with both of them.
And two, the self is going to ask a lot more of you because it really is not that aware of our human limitations.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the reality that you have to live in,
yeah,
too.
Yeah. As I say, I think on the whole, for the average person, they give up on the potential realm. And they, if it's not, you know, if it's not real, and if it's not possible, well, that's silly, you know. I remember for a small example, I remember Tom Healy telling me when he was one of the guys that tried to get the Monon Trail put in, and they go before a politician, they just laugh. Well, that'll never work. No one will ever do that. You know, this whatever is taken as the highest standard. That's what you got to be careful of. That's what the average person has to be careful of. So I heard the rushing of wings. I knew the bird rose higher above the clouds in the fiery brilliance of the outspread Godhead.
Now, why does he talk about his Godhead being up there in the fiery brilliance when it was a worm crawling on a fiery earth?
Well, I think what he's getting straight is how those two are linked. You get to that aspect of the Godhead through the worm. That's what he's discovering. That's the new revelation. And here, I would take the fiery Godhead to mean the brilliance of your potential. We don't get anywhere near it yet, but I think eventually where he's going to go with that is that self isn't just in me, it's in the world. And by hearing the self's plan for my life, I engage in the world in the way that I need and the world needs at the same time. So it expands way out beyond the person. But he still doesn't even have the concept of the self clear yet. We'll see a footnote dealing with that coming
up. You don't think he does?
Well, I don't think so, no.
I guess I keep thinking on his study of Hinduism and the self that he's already undertaken.
I don't think so.
You don't think so what now?
I don't think he's gotten that far yet.
Well, in his paintings, he refers to the texts, the Sanskrit texts, and Atman and Purusha, and the difference between the two.
But was that added later?
Not that I'm aware of.
Because, I mean, these books, he had like a red book, then he had a black book, or the opposite.
Yeah.
I mean, this was redone over time. So I'm not sure the first time through he had that.
Well, it's a good question, and I am not sure. Here it is, Carol. See, I used to want to lose where we are. We are on
335.
If you go to 337, as far as I can see, this is only the second reference in the Red Book to the word self. It was used before. I don't remember where it was. I did make a note. But, it's a good question. Let's look at it. And thus spoke Zarathustra, footnote 29, 337. The self, so that's much later, right? The self also seeks with the eyes of sense. It too listens with the ears of the spirit. The self is always, let's get a little bit low. Okay.
Do we know when he read Zarathustra for the first time?
When he was in college, I think. But said he didn't understand it.
But Nietzsche spoke about the self in those terms.
Yeah, so he's quoting. I started a little too early. Go down a little farther on that footnote. Jung said, see where it says, mm-hmm. Jung said, I was already very interested in the concept of the self, but I was not sure how I should understand it. I made my marks when I came across these passages, and they seemed very important to me. The concept of the self continued to recommend itself to me. I thought Nietzsche meant a sort of thing in itself behind the psychological phenomenon. I saw then also that he was producing a concept of the self which was like the Eastern concept. It is an Atman idea.
Very weird about Atman.
Well, it's the idea that there's an inner, there's like an inner self and there's an outer self. There's an Atman and a Brahman. And that the inner self is a particularization of the outer self. It's just that there's a cosmic and a personal dimension to the self. That's the Indian idea.
Is a particularization?
Yeah, or it's a little bit of the Brahman is in us, and that little bit of the Brahman in us is the Atman. So in our language, it's the personal self and the collective self. And I think, I have to track down the reference, but excuse me, I'm pretty sure that he got that from Hinduism. I think he says at one point, flat out, I got the concept of self from Hinduism. I forget which, maybe the Bhagavad Gita or Upanishads, I don't remember which. Yeah. So, go back to your question, Carol. I think the idea is in Genesis, but it's not yet firm at this point.
I guess we'd have to go back and discover when he actually read the Upanishads.
Yeah, it would be a very interesting work. It would be nice to know somebody who knew Jung, just step by step how this occurred to him. Mm-hmm. I think we can say generally from the rough information. But what did he read? What was he thinking on this year? That'd be very interesting. What I would conclude so far is he's got a beginning idea. It's nowhere near his final grasp of what the self is. That didn't come to 1928. But I can't be sure. But it's things like this that lead me to think that it was slowly germinating in process, but not yet finalized. That's a good question. I think it'd be a damn interesting essay to lay that out. And to really go back and see how he conceived of it so that we understand the full import of what he's talking about. Well, we start getting references to, you okay so far, everybody? Talks about the sacrifice, the rushing of wings, so that the potential world is, he's allowing the potential world its separate existence, not defiled by the communications of reality. I mean, just, again, imagine you're talking to a politician about the social value of analysis. Well, they'd think you're crazy. What's all this money you're spending? This is, you know, we're not going to get insurance to support this. This makes no contribution to general life.
You damn navel gazer.
You'd give up. You know, but then there's Rosa Parks. One person follows her heart, and the whole world changes. So you never know what impact your work's going to do. Going to have anyway. We get a couple of references to the war. About two-thirds of the way down in the first column, I still did not know what the future held. This happened on the 21st of May in the year 1914. So the Second World War is May, June, July, August. It's August it started, I think, right? 4 months away. And I think when the war broke out, we'll see, he says, oh, this all started to make more sense. That he wasn't just carrying his own personal suffering. He was carrying issues that were behind the war.
We're going back a little before that, when he says, I turned to my brother, the eye.
Yeah.
He stood sadly and looked at the ground inside. Now, coming on the heels of all that self-criticism at the beginning, at that point there was this I that he was lambasting. Is that the same I that we're talking about here? Is that the lambasting?
I also don't know. I think we have to say that there are two I's. There's like, or maybe there's an I and a me. It gets very confusing. I don't feel that what he's saying is the voice of the unconscious, that the I here is the ego. But the brother might be the ego looking at itself. It's something like that. It's consciousness reflecting on itself. That's how I understand that, Carl. Although I'm not sure. Or it's the him thinking about himself, and then there's the him who has to do something about it. Something like that. It's very confusing.
Well, that's exactly what we do.
That is what we do, yeah. What shall I do today? Shall I go to the shopping, or shall I go swimming? Well, there's the eye talking to the eye.
Mm-hmm. It seems like the other eye has taken up more of the shadow this time because it talks about itself being loaded with the dead. As though it's got a connection to the unconscious that way.
Right. And I think, well, hang on for that. You know, we'll get there. I just want to get to the blood bit. No drink is dearer to me than blood. That's the soul. Now that's a complicated statement. On the one hand, I think, remember we had in the vision seminar, Jung's statement, sometimes you can pay in blood and sometimes you can pay in wine. Meaning that sometimes you have to make mistakes in life that cost you suffering that is very dear as blood. And there's other times when you can avoid that situation and work it out in your imagination. That's paying in wine. In other words, you meet somebody and you simply cannot resist physical contact with that person. And it's a disaster. Well, you've just paid in blood. But if you hadn't had that relationship, you would not have learned something valuable you needed to move forward in life. So that payment in blood is necessary. Now, the Christian wing of my field will say, well, you can work it out in imagination. That's bullshit. You got to live it out. Sometimes you have to live it out. That's what Jung is saying in the vision seminar. But once you've been burned a couple of times, you meet somebody, you can say, ah, I've been down this road before. I'm going to take that person as an inner figure and work it out in imagination. You can do that because you've already lived through a similar experience. But there are situations in life, if you're going to live deeply, that you cannot avoid paying in blood. That's what I think that means here. That's what this means here. That these ideals require blood giving in life to understand them.
But even if you work it out in your imagination as wine, you're still feeling all of the emotions and attachment and desire for that thing or individual. And so you are still giving in blood. But
it's not having destructive.
Filling it out
You're not having destructive consequences to your marriage or to your friendships or to your bank account or God knows what. Now, but I think there might be another sense to that, which is the war. And here I'm kind of at a loss to express it, but that there is a world soul that is not being paid attention to. And since it's not being paid attention to, it is actually creating war. And it's a death mother that wants the blood of battle.
So is that why he sees with bitterness at her, at what she says right above him?
Yes, but in both senses, that he's seeing how he is paying in blood for Tony Wolf, and something he enjoys it, but he's seeing the effect on his marriage, and that upsets him. So the blood requirements of his soul disturb him. And he's also seeing its effect on his children. You know, the fact, remember, the mothers wouldn't let their kids play with his kids. And he's also, I don't think at this point, but later down the road, he's going to see, that's what this damn soul demands. It demands blood. And we either give it to it consciously or it takes it unconsciously. And the social consequence of that blood demand is war.
So you think that's why you put this in here? This happened on May.
I am not sure. I'm speculating.
Okay.
But I think there might be a connection between what he's paying in blood and the blood he's going to be seeing spilled on European soil.
So the world's the world soul hasn't been satisfied? Well,
yes.
In what sense?
Well, and it's like, again, I'm speculating, Carl, that we each have a soul in us that demands we live our life. part of that living of life is living through difficult situations and paying that price. And each of that soul in ourselves is a little piece of a world soul. And to the extent that we continue to ignore, if enough people continue to ignore that personal challenge, that leaves the world soul unsatisfied. And it's going to get its blood one way or the other. I mean, it's just, if you just look at, you know, just even the Syrian, the footage of the Syrian fighting, it's just this need to spill blood. Why? Because there is a part of the human psyche demanding blood on the earth. It's not about, I mean, it's partly about liberty and justice and so on. But beneath all that, the joy you see in their faces of killing each other, that's a demon.
That's what?
That's a demon. And that demon wants blood to spill on the earth. Now, that's my guess. That this blood drinking has two levels. And there is a relationship between the divine plan and the soul and the blood and the ego. And all of those have to have their place. And that's what he's getting straight here.
So when he says a couple sentences down, the divine consumes the human,
yeah,
then that's what he's talking about.
Yep. Okay. And it even gets more graphic. Let the bloody victims fall at your side. It is not your severity, it is not your cruelty, but necessity. The way of life is sown with fallen ones. Now, remember, that's the soul speaking. He doesn't have to agree with it. But there is a voice. There is a component of the human psyche that feels just like this, and we are pathetically out of touch with it. You see, he reacts against her statement. He groans, the top of 335. And she says, are you groaning? He says, why should I not groan and moan? I load myself with the dead and cannot haul their numbers. Now, again, I understand that in several ways. One, the blood that he is giving in this affair.
That's his. That's the second part of his ego answering, right? Then my eye answered. Because the eye has just arrived.
Yes,
my brother.
I would take those almost the same.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's me talking to me.
Mm-hmm.
Or him his consciousness reflecting on what the ego is saying. That's how I get it, Carol. But I load myself with the dead and cannot haul their numbers. The dead would be the blood he's shedding himself. The dead would be what he will soon realize is World War I. And that what he's doing, he's taking on himself some of the dynamics that are behind war. And the dead, we saw earlier, are our past ancestral traditions. Remember that? The dead came... But they came from Jerusalem, I forget exactly where they came from. But just as he's about ready to get rid of Christianity, the dead come on the scene, and he realizes they represent all the past truths. And all of those are different aspects of the same experience. And then another part of him says, why bother? Let the dead bury the dead. And then he responds, but it's part of my job to deal with the tragedy of human life. And as far as the soul is concerned, the misery of humanity doesn't bother her. Follow the God without compassion.
Well, because that thing is future-oriented, it hopefully knows where all of that suffering and blood spilling is leading, at least.
I don't think so.
You don't think so?
I don't think it cares. It's like a forest fire. You know, the earth needs to be regenerated, so I'm going to burn all these people out of their house and home and kill all the animals. It's concerned with the long-term evolution of life.
That it's renewing life by that fire.
Yeah, but the fact that it's killing life to do so doesn't bother it one bit.
Okay.
Now, the ego's got to say, but I can't.
Yeah.
And that's what he's wrestling with. As I step back from this, if I throw this out, it might help make some sense that he's dealing with several concerns. The self is ruthless. The self wants its intent realized no matter what the cost is to the individual. Unfortunately, I am that individual and I happen to care about the cost. So, compassion and compassionlessness exist in attention. And we've got to try to find a way through those opposites. That's humane. That's what he's working with now. There are times when you're following the self, you have to hurt other people. But you have to know you're doing it. There are other times when you have to pay more attention to the compassion side of life and maybe hold those ideals in abeyance for a time. We'll see coming up pretty soon. And then there's the whole question of what compassion do you extend to others? You can hear Nietzsche in here a little bit. Of course, compassion to other people is one of the highest accomplishments of the human spirit. On the other hand, as we'll see, if you are compassionate in the wrong way, all you do is make people dependent on you. So all of these considerations are going through him, and
finds what compassion is. Sometimes compassion can be letting the thing that's in place happen.
That's what he's trying to get clear. When do I allow pain to happen in the other person? When do I assuage that pain? I think in our jargon today we would say, what is codependent caring? What is genuine caring? He didn't have those words back then. So it's so easy to get lost in all the little details here. But I think if you can bring that general question to this text, it helps. Ruthlessness of the self. Sometimes the ego must serve that ruthlessness. Human compassion for myself and for others. The limits of compassion for myself and others. All of these are variables. There is no single recipe. We have to be aware of all the factors and forge a solution each moment. It's kind of deep stuff.
Well, it goes against so much of what we've learned.
Yes, that's the point.
Being compassionate, always being compassionate.
And he came up with that term, you know, faithless eros. We talked about it, I think. When you have to, in serving love for another person, allow them to struggle painfully. But, you know, the classic example is that I thought was a marvelous scene in the movie Ray. We talked about that, I think, where in the movie, Ray Charles, is his biography, he lost it, he went blind as a, he was born with sight, but at about 4 or 5, he had an eye disease, probably today it would be cured, anyway, he went blind. And in the movie, it's apparently a true story, it shows Mom and little Ray, who's just gone blind, and Ray drops his marbles. I get emotional just to think about it. And the mother wants to go pick him up, but he reaches for them. And he bangs his head, he knocks over things, and she lets him suffer to get his own marbles. See, that's faithless eros. The real loving thing.
Crying
the entire time.
The mother is.
Yeah. See, the Christian's charity would say, well, you help the other person. And faithless eros is love sometimes allows the other person their own pain. And as the only way they will grow up. And a codependent personality will never understand that.
Why are you being mean to me?
Why are you being mean to me? So that meanness and eros are at points aren't opposites. And I think that's what's being worked out. So you got the soul, you got compassion, you got God without compassion, you've got the soul without compassion, you've got the importance of compassion, you've got, well, maybe we should stop there and pick up. What have you noticed? Because he then gets into the war. So we'll say we went as far as what have you noticed? That's
I see.
3/4 of the way down.
Did we do like 2 pages maybe?
Probably. Let me see. We got through one. I think we should not go by pages, by columns.
Okay.
We got through 1/2 of a column, 3.5 columns,
4.5,
almost 5 columns. We got through 2.5 pages. But it's tough. But do you feel its richness? Yeah. And it's like, as I envision it, all of this is, okay, I had this wonderful experience, now how do I apply it?
How do I live it?
How do I live it? Am I living it? What's it requiring of me? And one of the things is, once you realize what the self is, which you've begun to realize, it brings up this whole problem of compassion. Everything changes. You can't just go through life helping people. Because what you do is you steal from them the chance of developing their own self. Yet there are times when you do need to help people, and so on. None of that is clear to him yet. It is becoming clear to him. Well, so we read 330. We read to 339. Well, we didn't either, so don't feel bad. Just wondering how much to read. We probably won't get farther than that, do you think?
No. There's a lot in there.
And if we do, we'll just relax. Chew on it. So I would say no new reading. To 339 before bracket number 4. Thank you for hanging in there. I know it's not easy. I do feel it's rich.
Yeah.